or Skype or Zoom or FaceTime and listen to them, giving them a chance to talk. When this happens, I found that nowadays we lose patience, or we're growing up a different lifestyle. But if you go sit with somebody and you give them those messages, I've sat with people, I was sitting with a young man, his sister murdered somebody, and he was traumatized. He was withdrawing. So I went to sit beside him and I said, I'm here. If you need a hug, I'll give you a hug. If you need to talk, I'll listen. Otherwise, I'm just going to sit here with you. So I sat there, it must be 5 minutes. Then he starts talking. He's saying, I don't know what to do. I don't know what people think about me and my sister, my family. So he started talking about his fear. And counselors know, as soon as someone starts talking, disclosing their what's making them feel bad or causing suffering, that 50% of the stress leaves that body once they're truthful with somebody else. So that's what I would suggest we do with the ones in Nova Scotia. And with the patients, you know, I can only imagine the fear they have being in the hospitals and things, and wondering if they're going to get the virus. I think about that. I thought about it in the times when I see people supporting them by banging pots and pans and tooting horns. It's actually brought tears to my eyes that there's nurses and doctors that are being supported. I tell the patients when I used to go to the hospitals, you become an active participant in your healing. You listen to those doctors and nurses. You participate in this healing, and if it means distancing, you do that. No matter how uncomfortable it is, you don't go out in that hallway. If they tell you to stay there, you stay there. It's really important that we learn how to listen now, all of us. Total listen. And the ones that know, the knowledgeable people that talk to us, the ones that really know. There's a lot of people now that will say things that, but they don't really know. Like me talking about the virus, I'll make sure I'll say, I know that it will live on a surface, like in a surface of my computer here. If that virus lands there, I was told it can live up to 72 hours on a solid surface. That means if it's sitting there for a day and I go touch that surface and I touch my eyes or my mouth, it's going to enter me. I believe that because a professional gave that message. So I believe that. So that's why the patients, we tell them, now is the time to listen. And it might get more uncomfortable for you. But this is for your good and for the good of everyone. It's like that saying, the honor of all is the honor of one is the honor of all. The safety of one is the safety of all. You know, they can help in the hospital as patients. You know, by listening. And also, the next part of my talk here is going to be about doing ceremony. And I would like more people to start to do that. So when I get a chance to talk about that, I'll share that.
Yeah, absolutely, Jerry. Thank you. Thank you for that. And I agree. I think it's important for us to recognize and acknowledge experts at this time, right? Whether it's an expert like an elder or a knowledge keeper, or a doctor or a health professional, right? I think now is actually a really good time to pivot, and let's chat about ceremony at a distance.
Okay, first off, ceremony is an event that human beings do. And it either can be a spiritual event, a religious event, or a public event. So public events like graduation ceremony. Oh, our children walk across the stage with those robes on and we cry, that's a good ceremony. Because they've gone through 12 years of school, 4 years of college or university, and there they are. That's a ceremony. You know, that's a public event ceremony. Then religious ceremonies, to me, are like Catholic, Muslim, those kinds of things, where they have a belief and a faith. Then the spiritual ceremonies are ceremonies to nourish the human spirit, to heal the human body, mind, and spirit. That's what the ceremonies are for me in the spiritual realm. And that we can do this. Like I do a ceremony every day when I light my smudge bowl, the medicine, and take it in. That's a ceremony. And it's something I'll do consistently. So we can do that, and as soon as we help ourselves, we're helping our relatives and our friends, because we're strengthening ourselves. I used to wonder why my aunties used to laugh, and they have sparkly eyes. They say, "Oh, where are you going, son?" "Oh, I'm going to have a sweat." And they'd laugh, and they'd be happy, and they'd say, "Oh, good." And I figured out later they knew that at some point I'm going to pray, I'm going to send energy to them through prayer or through music. Because during ceremony, there's a partner for the female energy. And that's all of the females that are our family and our friends. I've been sending energy to when the females, you know, to the researchers that are looking for a cure, women, or the women doctors, the women nurses, the janitors, the cooks, all those frontline workers in the hospital that are female, I'll send energy for them through ceremony from a distance. And because our thoughts are energy. Even because every thought you have is a muscular reaction in your body. If you're panicky, you know, your tummy, you'll feel in your tummy like butterflies in your tummy. And your breathing will be affected. You might start hyperventilating or suffocating by hardly breathing. So every thought creates an action in our body. So when we think of other human beings, like say that are Nova Scotia, and we think positive things to them, that energy goes through the air to them, or through the earth to them. If you're in the sweat lodge, like in the sweat lodge, all those willows are in the earth. So it's part of the earth, and the energy from there goes, travels through the earth. That's how we can send in ceremony, send help to loved ones or people that, like, now I don't know those doctors that are working in front line, but I send them energy, you know, because they're putting their life on the line. We need to do what we can do. And that's what I do, you know. And it's so I can do that sitting in sweat lodge, or sitting in front of my smudge bowl, or standing outside underneath a spruce tree. I can put myself in that state of sending energy. But, you know, the way that I started, I wasn't always like this. The way I started, I always had to have a smudge bowl or a sweat lodge before I thought I can do ceremony. But now I've come to the belief that Indigenous people live ceremony life. When they have a drink of water, I see an elder like this. I said to one of the aunties, "How come the old man's got that glass of water to his forehead?" She said, "He's talking to the water, thanking the water for his life." And she says, she knows him, and she says, also, he's asking that his grandchildren, great-grandchildren, have water too. So that was a ceremony, the drinking the water ceremony, you know. I feel today that to put ourselves into the state of ceremony is critical. Remember, it's a spiritual, public, or religious event. So when we're into spirit mode, of other people's spirit. Because everybody that's walking around today have a spirit. If it's weak, they don't have that will to live. They're reckless. They say, oh, no, I'm going to go out and demonstrate, you know, open up the business. To me, that's a sign of a weak spirit. It doesn't really want to live. My spirit was very weak when I was addicted. When I was into alcohol and drugs, my spirit was weak. In a sense, I didn't want to live. It was a slow suicide drinking. I'm not ashamed to admit that, because that was real. And I had to beat that. And what pulled me out of it is ceremony. Consistent ceremony. Not when I need it, but do it consistently. And ceremony is about asking for help, appealing sincerely for help around a specific issue like coronavirus, grief and loss, or celebration. Oh, all of a sudden my children got a name in the longhouse or in the community. They got an indigenous name. That's a celebration. Ceremony. Or coming of age. That's one that I pray that will come back. And we do coming of age with all of our ones that are going to become men and women. I really pray hard that comes back eventually. Because that ceremony, I feel, prepares those ones to be men and women. Because my view today is that we got a lot of 25, 30-year-old people still acting like kids. Because I know I come from that too. I didn't go through puberty ceremony until I was 27 years of age. It's not too late to do those things. I had to go look at myself to see what my purpose is in life. Why am I here? So I do that in ceremony, isolation ceremony. There's ceremonies where there's 500 people in a room, 20 people in a room. Then we also do our own individual ceremonies. And that's what I'd like to encourage people to do, to find a way. You can ceremony with the five elements in mind. Fire, you can light a candle. Light a candle for those people in Nova Scotia. That's fire. Not about Christianity, it's about fire. You can put down a bowl of water for the people in Nova Scotia, or wherever, because water is life. When you think of those elements and how to use them, like the plant that comes out of the earth, we could put that down like sweetgrass, cedar, sage, hemlock, all of the medicines. We could put that down and it's like creating a sacred space for ceremony. I know people that light a candle and they're in ceremony. When I light my smudge bowl and I sit and meditate, I'm in ceremony. I encourage people to find a way, to develop your way to ceremony. Because it's about helping others. Being compassionate, that means you're a willing participant with other people's suffering. If someone is depressed, you'll go participate them in a way to try and help them out of that. If someone is angry, you'll try to help them. You'll send energy to them. That's what I do. I pray when I send energy. I say, I want teachers and healers for my grandchildren. Because I can't see them now. So I want teachers and healers to come into their life. I'll send that energy through the air. Like my podcasts are called Teachings in the Air that I do. And that's what it's referring to, that everything we have comes through the air for us as human beings. Medicines come through the air to us and they become part of our body. Just like food, like deer meat becomes part of my body. So I learned to respect the deer meat, the salmon. When I first started doing ceremonies in 1976, it kept I kept expanding because all the ceremonies were about myself when I first started. Keep me sober. I don't want those drugs. I don't want that booze in my system. That was my ceremony. And after I got stronger, then I started to think of other people. Then I started sending energy to my loved ones, to my friends. Or if someone makes a request to me. People have asked me to send energy to mothers, women that want to have a baby. So I do that. And the requirement to do ceremonies is to be sincere. It means mean it and believe it. Mean more, especially is mean it, what you're doing. You say, I'm really sincere about this. That's what you say to your, that's what the energy is about you. You're sincere. You're not lying. You're not making up. You're doing it.
Of BC does have limited entry hunting regulations, which means that there's usually only so many moose tickets for other game management zones. And once those tickets have been filled by hunters, there are no more moose available to hunters who live in southern BC. So what they all do is they head north to our territory, and quite frankly, it's like a huge migration, you know, often, and I'm only guessing, but it's based on years of observation, that there's probably between 3,000 to 5,000 hunters that come up and essentially take over the prime moose habitat. And they basically are everywhere. They're everywhere you can imagine. There was at least some ability for the moose population to be able to right itself after the annual hunt. Nowadays, it doesn't have that opportunity. Moose do not have opportunity. I have been to the top of Tabletop and was surprised to see like a ton of different hunting camps up on the top of the mountain. You have pressure coming from the top of the mountain and pressure coming from the river banks, rooting out moose to the point where they don't have a chance. There's no chance. Of moose in our territory, and it's very distressing, especially for those of us who grew up eating moose, and we look at moose not as a sport but as a pure sustenance for feeding our families. When I harvest a moose, I feel really sad about taking a moose's life, and I give thanks and I do ceremony and I take everything I can of the moose, because that moose gave its life so that we can survive. We pay it a certain amount of respect and reverence. And it's really difficult to film hunting camps where I've literally seen a moose carcass rot on the ground. We're having a lot of those kinds of issues. There's been a lot of issues where we have witnessed wastage on the land, because often they take the head and the antlers, they take some of the choice cuts, and they leave the rest behind. And we need to start doing something more aggressively to protect the moose population, otherwise they're disappearing. They're gone. Traveling the highway was that you would run into a moose, because if we saw any movement off of the sides of the roads, that we were to tell our parents right away while they were driving, see a moose, see a moose. We don't even do that anymore. Nobody even worries about seeing a moose on the road anymore, because the fact of the matter is they've been hunted to the point where that they no longer come to the roadways. They no longer are in the sloughs that are parallel to the highways. They're no longer in the places where we always knew them to be. They're being overhunted. It's really sad. And it makes me angry. And from my aunts and my uncles and my cousins, just about everybody I came into contact in one way or another, moose was king. From a very young age, from the moment I could understand the world around me, moose have been a part of that existence. Those memories are beautiful, of watching your auntie go up and cut a piece of the cheek off Auntie Raina and eating that and going, or my Uncle Hector, you know, and just dancing around with joy, eating the moose head, telling us their memories of eating the moose and how they used to do it. Indigenous people, that if salmon and moose and caribou and other traditional food sources disappear, then how are we any different from the people that go to the supermarket? It is true that you do reduce culture by removing culturally appropriate and significant food sources. It is true that you do reduce culture by removing that culturally appropriate, reduce culture by removing culturally appropriate and significant food sources.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Climate change will cause more intense droughts, extreme flooding, and crippling heat waves in many parts of the world. In response, some people may become climate refugees. But Aylin Benvenist of Harvard University found that as conditions become more extreme, it will get harder for many of the world's poorest and most vulnerable people to move, so some will be unable to escape.
It's costly to move, particularly if you're going to move further away, and especially if you're going to move across borders.
Climate change-driven heat waves, droughts, and floods can damage crops and destroy houses, pushing low-income people even further into poverty. Extreme weather could also make it more difficult for just one or two family members to move away and send money back home.
What that means is kind of a double whammy. You have climate change impacts in origin communities in those locations, but you also have limited options of having access to credit that is being sent back to origin communities because migrants are not being able to leave in the first place.
So Benvenist says that as much as the world is focused on climate refugees, we also need to pay attention to people who cannot afford to escape climate disasters at all. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.